Today is Friday, December the 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up in the next half hour, European Union leaders said that they would impose further economic sanctions on Russia if the Russian military invaded Ukraine. And President Joe Biden toured the aftermath of the deadly tornado strike that rampaged through the middle of the United States, doing the most damage in the state of Kentucky.
I intend to do whatever it takes, as long as it takes, as long as it takes, to support your state, your local leaders, and as you recover and rebuild, because you will recover and you will rebuild.
In Libya, a military blockade of the interim government's headquarters in Tripoli appears to have ended amid strong tensions just over a week before the scheduled presidential elections.
UN Special Envoy to Libya, Stephanie Williams, met with rival political and military forces from eastern and western Libya in the port city of Sirte Thursday afternoon.
And the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has dismissed speculation that the African Football Cup of Nations, scheduled for January in Cameroon, could be again postponed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, President Joe Biden toured the aftermath of a deadly tornado strike that rampaged through the middle of the United States, doing the most damage in the state of Kentucky. Dozens were killed in that state alone, and more than 100 people are missing. VOA's White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from the White House.
Devastation, death, and despair. These are the sober scenes that President Joe Biden faced Wednesday as he toured three Kentucky communities hit hardest by the weekend's tornadoes: Fort Campbell, Mayfield, and Dawson Springs. The storms that tore through Kentucky and seven other states killed at least 88 people and left thousands homeless. On one street in the small city of Bowling Green, seven of the 14 victims were children. According to local news reports, one family on that street lost four small children. Their neighbors lost three. After visiting some of the devastation, Biden released additional disaster assistance, increasing federal funding over the next month to cover emergency work, debris removal, and direct federal assistance. He pledged that it would continue well into the future.
I intend to do whatever it takes, as long as it takes, as long as it takes, to support your state, your local leaders, and as you recover and rebuild, because you will recover and you will rebuild. You know, the scope and scale of this destruction is almost beyond belief.
What's causing this extreme weather? Victor Gensini, a professor of meteorology at Northern Illinois University, said human behavior is one reason tornadoes seem to have shifted from the southern states to the mid-south.
We think the spatial changes are due to climate change, with the southern plains of Texas and Oklahoma sort of drying out, becoming a more arid, desert-like landscape. That pushes the severe weather threat further north and further east, because of these changing climate conditions. And that, of course, is a huge deal, because if you have more tornadoes in areas like Mayfield, Kentucky, we have more people, right? More population density as you go east of the Mississippi River. Lots more targets on the dartboard, if you will, more assets to hit.
One thing that the administration can do, he said, is take a stronger position on building codes.
These buildings, many of them popping up all over the country, data centers, Amazon warehouses, whatever it is, they're built like kites. We ought to look at mandating these types of companies that are in charge of hundreds of people at any given time in a warehouse have access to safe shelter.
That, Biden said, is part of his signature domestic policy initiative to improve infrastructure through a juggernaut bill that passed narrowly along party lines. The state's Democratic governor, Andy Beshear, said the outpouring of support transcends politics.
The generosity and outpouring of love, pure, unconditional love from around this country and around this world has been overwhelming. Millions of dollars and more water, diapers, sweatshirts, household goods than we could ever count have poured in. As a state, we are also not alone. President Biden and the federal government have offered more aid and acted faster than we have ever seen in the history of the United States of America.
Kentuckians, he said, are good, hopeful people, and they will build back their lives together. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
European Union leaders agreed on Thursday that they would impose further economic sanctions on Russia. In a statement, the NATO allies said that they supported the right of all countries to decide their own future and foreign policy free from outside interference. The warnings at the EU summit follow similar warnings by the U.S. following Biden and Putin's virtual summit last week. President Joe Biden warned that the West would impose strong economic and other measures on Russia if it invades Ukraine, while Putin demanded guarantees that NATO would not expand further eastward. As the United States and its NATO allies seek to deter any possible Russian attack on Ukraine, many observers are not sure of Putin's end goal, given that other Baltic, Central and Eastern European states like Lithuania believe that they are under assault from Russia on multiple fronts. So what is influencing Putin's foreign policy agenda? And how far are the NATO allies willing to go to deter his ambitions? Joining me to discuss this and more is Julia Yoff, the Washington correspondent and founding partner for PAC News, where she covers national security and foreign policy.
You know, for a person who knows a little bit of the history here, and Putin specifically, what is his guiding philosophy on how he understands the issue of Ukraine? How does he view, for example, Russia's cultural, historical ties with countries like Ukraine? And does that fit in his geopolitical objective?
Absolutely. So in July, he put out an op-ed, a very long op-ed, going through the history, like the 1,000 years of history between Ukraine and Russia, which used to be the same thing. Russia got its start in Kiev. It was called Kievan Rus, and it spread from Kiev up north, east, and west. But, you know, that was 1,000 years ago. But now he's saying, you know, in July, he wrote this op-ed, and he said, we're basically the same people. We have the same culture. We have the same religion, and we've had it for 1,000 years. You know, very eerily, he used the term blood ties. You know, this is something he has said before. He said in 2008 to George W. Bush that Ukraine isn't a real country. You know, for them, it's only been, let's say you're 70 years old and it's only the last 30 years that Ukraine has been independent as opposed to the same country as you. And until Putin invaded in 2014, Ukraine was Russia's closest ally. They are very culturally, linguistically similar. A lot of people in Russia have Ukrainian roots, and a lot of people in Ukraine have Russian roots. So it is problematic when you have a leader who doesn't recognize Ukraine as a sovereign country. You have a similar situation in China with Taiwan, right? And like, how do you even negotiate with somebody like that, right? When they're just dealing with a different reality than you are, and that they don't respect the sovereignty of this other country.
In your view, does what China is doing with Taiwan and the entire Southeast China Sea embolden Russia?
It's the fact that they're doing it and largely getting away with it. Because I think the U.S. has shown, and this is something that isn't talked about enough, I think, in Washington, that in terms of foreign policy, there has been a lot of continuity from Obama to Trump to Biden. This kind of pulling back off the world stage, not wanting to use the military as aggressively, not wanting to be, quote unquote, the world's policeman, right? Whereas China and Russia are very happy to be the world's policeman, right? And the more we say that, the more we're reluctant to push really hard when China does what it does in the South China Sea, or Russia does what it does in Ukraine, right? Yeah. And then the other thing about China is that, you know, I would say like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, if the U.S. put all kinds of sanctions on Russia, it would be much more devastating, or kick them out of certain institutions. It was more devastating. Now, China is increasingly offering a plausible alternative for financing, for energy markets. It's creating international bodies, you know, to kind of counterbalance the IMF and the World Bank. And now it's trying to create its own WHO. So the more that's happening, the more Russia is like, all right, fine, punish us, America.
Absolutely. Which brings me to my next question is, you know, Russia is already under, you know, some form of economic sanction since, what, 2014. So at this point, what kind of leverage does the Biden administration have to put pressure on the Kremlin?
There are things that the U.S. can do, or that the Biden administration can do. And they wouldn't affect us all that much because the U.S. doesn't have that, isn't closely tied to Russia in terms of trade. But there are things that we could do that would really hurt our allies, like Germany or France, especially Germany. So, you know, this was being talked about behind the scenes before the meeting. And then Jake Sullivan came out and said it on Wednesday. He said, you know, if Russia invades, Nord Stream 2 is dead. Yeah, but it also sucks for Germany, right? And if the U.S. cuts Russia off from the SWIFT international financial system, it's going to be really painful for Russia, but it's also going to be really painful for Germany and the, you know, the various European countries who depend on Russia for fuel, who have lots of, you know, economic ties and trade ties with Russia. And I think that's the other problem, is that the European, our European allies don't want to really suffer for this, for, you know, for Ukraine.
They might not have the same convictions as America has in...
Well, not even imposing. That. It's like, I think they have the same convictions, but they have more skin in the game than the U.S., right? So if you're the German leader or the French leader, you're like, okay, do I want to take a hit to my economy and maybe my political standing and my electoral chances for Ukraine, which is not in the EU, not in NATO? And Russia just wants it so badly. Putin has shown that he's willing to suffer a lot of economic pain for this. He just, that's how badly he wants it. Mm. It's worth it for him. And so,
that was Julia Yoff, the Washington correspondent and founding partner for PAC News. The U.S. Congress has approved an import ban targeting forced labor in China, while the Biden administration is imposing sanctions on Beijing over abuse of Uyghurs. AP's Ben Thomas reports.
The Senate has given final approval to a bill barring all imports from China's Xinjiang region unless businesses can prove they were produced without forced labor. Senator Marco Rubio.
It basically says that you can't import products into the United States that are made by slave labor.
He adds,
it's already illegal, by the way, to bring goods made with slave labor. It's been that way since the 1930s. And yet it's still happening.
Rubio says many companies have already taken steps to ensure their supply chains do not include products made by the forced labor of China's Uyghur population. And those who haven't will no longer be able to make Americans
unwitting accomplices in the atrocities and the genocide that's being committed by the Chinese Communist Party.
Meanwhile, the Commerce Department levied new sanctions targeting Chinese biotech and surveillance companies, a leading drone manufacturer, and government entities for their actions in Xinjiang. Ben Thomas, Washington.
And thousands of American soldiers that have not been vaccinated could be removed from the military next month. AP's Mike Hampen has more.
The Army says 98% of its active duty force received at least one dose of the mandatory coronavirus vaccine by this week's deadline. That's the second highest rate among the four military services. However, more than 3,800 soldiers refused to get vaccinated. The Pentagon announced earlier this year that the COVID-19 vaccine was mandatory for all service members. The Army has said it will begin involuntary separation proceedings for soldiers who refuse the vaccine. Mike Hemp in Washington.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. A man from Afghanistan who chased away a gunman who murdered 51 people at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand in March of 2019 has been given the country's highest bravery award, the New Zealand Cross. From Sydney, Phil Massa reports.
Abdulaziz is among 10 people recognized for their courage during the March 2019 attacks on two mosques in the New Zealand city of Christchurch. The former refugee from Afghanistan threw a credit card machine at the gunman after he'd opened fire at the Linwood Islamic Center. He ignored the bodies of murdered worshippers and ran toward the attacker, chasing him with a rifle the gunman had discarded. Aziz has been awarded the New Zealand Cross for his courage. He told Radio New Zealand that he simply wanted to protect his fellow worshippers.
If I didn't do that, we would lose a lot of our brothers and sisters, including myself as well. On that time, I'll be honest with you, I didn't even think about any danger or anything.
Another worshipper, Naeem Rashid, who died in the shootings after confronting the gunman at the Al Noor Mosque, has been posthumously honoured with the New Zealand Cross. Officials said his bravery too had saved lives. In a statement, his widow, Ambry Naeem, said the award is not only for him, but for every peace-loving person who stands against hate. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said the recipients of the bravery awards, including the two police officers who arrested the gunman, were selfless and extraordinary. Brenton Tarrant, a self-confessed white supremacist from Australia, is serving a life sentence for the shootings. He admitted to the murder of 51 people, the attempted murder of another 40 people who were injured, and one charge of terrorism. Many victims were migrants, including refugees from Syria, who went to New Zealand looking to escape conflict and violence. A judge said Tarrant's actions were inhuman. He will never be released from prison. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The war in Afghanistan was America's longest, spanning nearly 20 years. The U.S. in 2001 quickly toppled the Taliban government, who had harbored al-Qaeda terrorists responsible for the 9/11 terrorist attacks on America. But despite years of international support for Afghanistan, the war's final weeks saw a Taliban takeover, a chaotic U.S. withdrawal, and a massive terror attack that led nearly 200 people dead, including 13 U.S. service members. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carl Babb reports.
America's longest war finished. With al-Qaeda long diminished in Afghanistan, President Joe Biden told the Pentagon it was time to bring troops home. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby.
The military had, in fact, done what it was sent to do in Afghanistan, which was prevent that place from ever being a safe haven for a terrorist attack or a launching pad for a terrorist attack upon the homeland.
America's military had hoped to leave its Afghan partners with a fighting chance against the Taliban. Instead, the Taliban rolled into Kabul in mid-August, creating panic as U.S. evacuations began at Hamid Karzai International Airport.
There was a lot of chaos. There was a lot of confusion. I mean, the president of Afghanistan himself had just gotten on an airplane and flown out of the country, and nobody saw that one coming.
Afghan forces, trained and equipped by the U.S.-led coalition for 20 years, fell in fewer than 20 days. Some of those forces pointed to a lack of food, ammunition, and air support. Local leaders in areas across the country quickly made deals with the Taliban, forcing others to surrender or flee. Thomas Jocelyn is the editor of the Foundation for Defense of Democracy's Long War Journal.
Despite being at war for 20 years in Afghanistan, nobody really knew anything. They didn't really understand. The U.S. military leadership and political leadership didn't really understand who they were even fighting in Afghanistan, didn't understand the Taliban, didn't understand al-Qaeda, and didn't understand the relationship between those two.
The U.S. helped evacuate 124,000 people in just a few weeks. But that effort was marred by an Islamic State terror attack that killed nearly 200 people, including 13 American service members. Days later, a U.S. drone strike the Pentagon says was meant to hit Islamic State attackers mistakenly killed 10 innocent civilians. Meanwhile,
they won't let us go. They're gassing us and they're shooting at us.
The evacuation left hundreds of American citizens and thousands of Afghan allies behind. Rights groups reported revenge killings of U.S. allies in the months that followed. And the Taliban takeover sparked an economic meltdown. Martin Griffiths is the UN Humanitarian Affairs Chief.
The free fall of the economy is much more violent, severe, and urgent than we feared. We thought we would manage to survive the winter with pure humanitarian assistance. We now know it's not enough.
The UN says Islamic State Khorasan, once limited to small areas in Afghanistan, has now expanded to every province. And the UN says their attacks against the Taliban and civilians have increased fivefold this year. Speaking in an interview with Voice of America, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin vowed to use so-called over-the-horizon capabilities to continue to go after any terrorist in Afghanistan who plan to attack the United States.
That's making sure that that we pay attention to the threats as they evolve. And we will remain focused on that with a laser focus.
But the U.S. military now has only about 1-2% of the capabilities it once had to look into Afghanistan, the head of U.S. Central Command told the Associated Press. That makes the counter-terror mission there even more difficult. Meanwhile, for Afghans, the future under Taliban rule remains uncertain. Zalmay Khalilzad, the former U.S. envoy to Afghanistan, spoke to VOA about the transition.
There are mixed signals, some positive, some not. So we hope that it becomes all positive. The alternative is a repetition of the past, which would be, the suffering of the Afghan people, conflict, interference by outsiders in its affairs.
The world is watching to see if the Taliban will govern effectively and respect human rights, and if terror groups will thrive there again as they plot to attack the West. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
In other news, tens of millions of migrants may be denied COVID-19 vaccines from a global program because some major manufacturers are worried about legal risks from harmful side effects. That's according to officials and internal documents from Gavi, the charity operating the program. Nearly 2 years into a pandemic that has already killed more than 5 million people, only about 7% of people in low-income countries have received a dose. Vaccine deliveries worldwide have been delayed by production problems, hoarding by rich countries, export restrictions, and red tape. In Haiti, 12 Christian Aid Ministries missionaries held captive by a Haitian gang since October 16th have been released. A spokesperson for Haiti's National Police confirmed the news in a conversation with VOA Creole. They declined to provide any details. And for more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. And while there, check out our other programs, The Upfront Show, Music Time in Africa, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and others. And remember to connect with us on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and on YouTube, where you can watch our videos. Just search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. NASA's Parker Solar Probe became the first spacecraft in history to enter the sun's corona, or upper atmosphere. Rick Pantaleo has more in today's Science in a Minute.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA marked yet another milestone when it reported that their Parker Solar Probe dipped into the sun's corona, or upper atmosphere, on April 28th. They say it was the first time in history that any spacecraft was able to, as they put it, touch the sun. As the probe flew through the sun's corona, NASA reports that it sampled solar particles and magnetic fields. According to the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, Parker entered the corona 3 times on that day and at one point did so for up to 5 hours. NASA, via press release, says during the April flybys, the probe got as close as 15 solar radii, which is around 10.4 million kilometers, to the sun's surface. The space agency has and will conduct more close flybys and will eventually get as close to the surface of the sun as 8.86 solar radii, or 6.1 million kilometers. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
In Libya, a military blockade of the interim government's headquarters in Tripoli appears to have ended Thursday amid strong tensions in the Libyan capital just over a week before scheduled presidential elections. UN envoy Stephanie Williams met with key military leaders to try to prevent any violence which might jeopardize the elections. Edward Yerenian reports from Cairo.
UN Special Envoy to Libya, Stephanie Williams, met with rival political and military forces from eastern and western Libya in the port city of Sirte Thursday afternoon, hours after an Islamist militia group ended its siege of interim government headquarters in the capital, Tripoli. Tensions reportedly remain high in Tripoli just over a week before scheduled presidential elections. Islamist militia commander Salah Badi issued a video statement late Wednesday threatening to scuttle the planned December 24 election and claiming that he will throw UN envoy Williams out of Libya. The head of Libya's High National Election Commission, Imad Asaya, told journalists several days ago that preparations for the election are continuing on schedule. He said that he affirms to the Libyan people and political leaders that his committee will not ignore its obligation to hold free and fair elections, respecting the rights of all parties involved. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV, however, reported that another member of the commission called the December 24 election date wishful thinking. Libya analyst Aya Burwaila tells VOA that fair elections are possible provided that candidates who violate the UN roadmap and the electoral law are removed from the list of candidates, and foreign monitors are sent to polling stations to minimize the appetite of militia cartels in Tripoli who are hostile to elections. One former UN Libya envoy, Lebanon's Tariq al-Mitri, told Arab media that the only way to stabilize Libya is to dismantle the militias causing havoc in the country. Burwaila agrees, arguing that such militias are likely to attack and intimidate voters. Libyan Shiites are fed up and determined to exercise their basic right to choose their own government and take their country back after 7 years of foreign-appointed rule and militia occupation. However, Libyan analyst Azzedine Naguil told Al Arabiya TV that he thinks both Russia and Turkey are unlikely to remove their militia forces from Libya until they achieve their strategic goals, which will likely involve tough international negotiations. The leaders of two of Libya's closest neighbors, Algerian President Abdelmajid Tebboune and Tunisian President Kais Saied, met Wednesday to encourage Libyans to vote. Tebboune insisted that it is up to the people to decide their fate. He says that the solution in Libya is in the hands of the Libyan people, and they must get rid of mercenaries and foreign forces and deal with each other. Libya's parliament is due to meet in the eastern city of Baida early next week to make a final decision on whether to hold the election as scheduled. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The Confederation of African Football, CAF, has dismissed speculation that the Africa Football Cup of Nations, scheduled for January in Cameroon, could be again postponed because of the pandemic. CAF Secretary-General Veron Mosengo-Omba, during a visit to Cameroon Wednesday, said the spread of the Omicron variant could affect the number of fans allowed in stadiums. Nonetheless, he said, Cameroon was prepared to host Africa's top football tournament, as Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde.
The Confederation of African Football's Veron Mosengo-Omba says the Africa Football Cup of Nations AFCON tournament will begin in January as planned in Cameroon, despite the COVID pandemic. Britain's Daily Mail and Mirror newspapers this week speculated that the AFCON tournament, Africa's top soccer contest, might be cancelled amid a fresh wave of global infections fueled by the Omicron variant. Cameroon is expected to welcome thousands of international football fans for the games, which begin January 9 and go through February 6. Speaking Wednesday during a visit to Cameroon's coastal city Douala, the CAF's Omba said he was convinced that the host nation was ready to take appropriate measures. He says Cameroonian authorities have assured the CAF that the spread of COVID-19 will be reduced to a minimum during the football tournament. Moki Edwin Kinzeka. For VOA News, Yaounde.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very great weekend ahead.
This is the voice of America. Washington.